welcome to the third season of TwerpCast. I want to thank you longtime listeners for staying with us, and welcome new listeners alike. Over the past couple of years, sometimes we've felt lost, like we were on the fringe of podcasting, but we've never had to use an alias or felt it was a mission impossible. 3 years of taking care of business here at Twerp Online, and we still feel forever young. Sometimes I even feel like a star. Trek with us once more as we bring you AbramCast, TwerpCast number 28. We promise not to bring about Armageddon. I'd like to introduce you today to Britney Spears' number one fan and Paris Hilton's new BFF, James Caswell, executive producer of TwerpCast and Horndog to boot.
And that's Doug Zeitlin, co-executive producer of Twerps and creator of the Tooth and Nailoscope, a device that allows you to see 30 seconds into the future to see your next life obstacle.
I'm also the inventor of the TNAoscope.
But that one got you arrested.
Again, thank you for joining us today. This is our third annual Triple Threat TwerpCast. This year we've chosen as our victim, J.J. Abrams.
Jeffrey Jacob Abrams was born in New York, but raised in Los Angeles, the son of TV producer Gerald Abrams and executive producer Carol Abrams. He attended school at Sarah Lawrence College and decided that he wanted to follow in both of his parents' footsteps by becoming a producer, writer, and director. Over the years, he's established a reputation for himself for creating strange TV shows and also for casting friends of his. Now, we wouldn't know anything about that, would we, Doug?
Nope, we don't do television.
Now, there are some people who will probably look at this and go, hey, isn't this just part two of TrekCast 2009? The answer is...
yes, it is.
What's your point?
But seriously, there's more to J.J. Abrams than just the 2009 Star Trek. By the time he got to college, he'd already sold a treatment for a major motion picture, Taking Care of Business, starring Michael J. Fox.
It could easily be said that Abrams had celluloid running through his veins. Given his parentage, I think that's a fairly safe statement. He knew from the get-go what he wanted to do with his life, and he's doing it.
But really, right out the bat, Taking Care of Business made megabucks. Regarding Henry in 1991 with Harrison Ford is probably one of my favorite Harrison Ford movies of all time, when you take out the science fiction and fantasy genre.
When I realized that Regarding Henry was on his list of accomplishments, it actually raised him a level in my opinion, because Regarding Henry was a really good piece of drama, and to realize that he created that at such an early point in his career, A, it made me go, wow, he really has some talent, and B, made me sometimes wonder, okay, what happened?
Well, yes, what did happen? He wrote Gone Fishing and Armageddon, just amazing follow-ups to his initial success.
Yeah, seeing Armageddon on the list knocked him back down that peg.
Yeah, I was thinking, I still like him despite the fact he wrote Armageddon.
Now, don't get me wrong. Armageddon had a lot of the things that should have made for a great summer blockbuster, and there were a lot of people who liked it. We just happened to be two of them that didn't. I mean, it had Bruce Willis in it. It had Ben Affleck in it. Steve Buscemi, directed by Michael Bay. It had summer blockbuster written all over it. My biggest problem with it was that the movie should have been about 45 minutes shorter than it was, because by the time they hit the 27th obstacle in their path to complete their mission, I was just going, okay, you're doomed to fail. Forget it. Hang it up. Goodbye, Earth. So long, sucker.
Amazingly, because I really like J.J. Abrams as a writer, I feel this was just actually one of his weakest attempts at writing. And I do mean that as an attempt. It had all of the elements of a blockbuster movie. And by all accounts, by attendance and movie records and all that, I mean, it made a lot of money. It was successful for what it was doing. It just wasn't really fun. I gotta agree with your assessment that it was certainly 45 minutes too long. But it wasn't just at the ending where they were encountering obstacle number 32 of 45. It was in the middle of the movie, love scenes that made no sense at all. Having Liv Tyler in her first major motion picture performance, and she was awful. In the key scene where she's supposed to be crying and really feeling the loss of her father, the director shot the back of her head rather than indicate that she can't act.
Has your opinion of her changed at all in the 11 years that have passed?
Mildly. I don't avoid a movie because she's in it anymore. I thought she had a pretty good performance in Jersey Girl, but I'm like one of three people who actually likes that movie, and I'm including Kevin Smith as one of them. And she was actually passable in the Lord of the Rings flicks, but I have to say that probably has more to say about Peter Jackson than it does Liv Tyler.
I think I always had a little bit more respect for her acting ability than you did, but that doesn't say much.
I mean, she rates a 10 on the TNA scope, don't get me wrong.
Abrams followed up Armageddon by producing The Suburbans, and then in 2001 created Joyride. And you can tell that that was just the launching point of his career, right?
Well, not so much, but at least it gave him a good jumping off point to go into television.
Gave him a good excuse to go into television.
Potato, potato.
About the same time that Armageddon was released, a little show was being produced for the WB called Felicity.
Made Kerry Russell a star.
That it did. In 1998, I was just out of college, still had those warm, tingly feelings for living in the dorm room, being surrounded by lovable nutcases. So, the idea of watching Felicity was not a horrendous concept to me. It helped that Kerry Russell was a hottie, and...
The only thing I have to say about Felicity is, if I had known that J.J. Abrams had done Felicity, I would never have watched Alias.
In spite of the fact that Felicity was on for 4 years, it covered her entire college career, it wasn't until 2001 and the creation of the character Sidney Bristow that J.J. Abrams really stood up and got people's attention.
You know, we've never done an Alias cast, but I think it almost deserves its own retrospective cast, because this was just such spectacular action-adventure storytelling. Preface that with the fact that you really have to watch it in order.
And heaven forbid you miss an episode.
And you have to be willing to suspend your disbelief. It's pretty fantastic out there. But if you can put up with those three things, this is an awesome show.
Well, J.J. Abrams saw what was hot in the industry at that point in time. Buffy had already shown that the empowered, strong, leading woman was very popular and could go over really well with a wide audience.
Just look at Felicity. Storytelling-wise, she may have been the anti-Buffy, but here you have this strong female lead character. And really, Kerry Russell took all of America by storm.
But not only did he capture the idea of a strong female lead, but this really was where he started getting his reputation for the strange. This was the show that halfway through the series just pressed the restart button. This was the show that said, okay, we're just going to make her skip 2 years of her life, and she doesn't know what happened during those 2 years. Just to mess with your head a little bit.
That's actually one of the things that I really like about the show. He was willing to reinvent it every season. In the first season, there were the big bad guys. They were the one that everyone was out to get. And it looks like that's what the show is about. It's about Sidney Bristow versus the big bad guys. Well, in season two, he finished that story. He's basically like, that one's done now. Here's chapter two. And every year, you got something like that. The big one, of course, being the fact that she missed 2 years of her life, and the storytelling had to be kind of like Lost, where you learn slowly what happened during those 2 years.
But this type of storytelling really is the niche that he has become known for. He's shown that he can write the straight stuff, but when people say the name J.J. Abrams, most of the time you expect it to be just about 20 degrees off center.
That's actually a perfect way of putting it. And he's got a couple other shows out there in like 2006 and 2007. Yeah, What About Brian? This is a little comedy he's working on. 6 Degrees, about six residents of New York City and how their lives intertwine through the 6 degrees of separation. Neither of them really hit it off with the public. They didn't spark the imagination. Even though that's the case, that strange part that people have come to expect has kept him employed. 2004 starts this little tiny unknown show called Lost.
Lost was one of those really tricky shows, because initially it starts out as being an action drama. You have a bunch of people who are stranded on this deserted island. It comes across as being a more dramatized version of something like Survivor. But as the show developed, more and more of that strangeness creeps in.
As he's entered more and more science fiction and strange ideas, he's lost some of his viewership. When the show first came out, it was the number one hit in America. I mean, this was the water cooler show. Every week people were talking about this. It pretty much instantly got soaked up for a second season. This was something that they knew they wanted, they being the producers at ABC. But it started out with the science fiction themes being kind of hidden in the background and the drama being more intense and more important to the show. And now, as the show is in its fifth season, my personal favorite, it's practically all science fiction and the drama is kind of secondary. But, you know, I enjoy those explosions and gunfights and things.
Really? You? Nah.
But now they've lost some of that initial sparkle. Not all of it. And they're going to wrap the show up next year, just saying they've done the beginning, they've done the middle, this is going to be the end. Lost will be the very first TV show that I buy on Blu-ray.
But it was because of his success on Alias and on Lost that got a lot of his more recent projects handed to him. In 2006, he returned to the big screen again, this time doing the writing and the producing and the directing himself with Mission Impossible 3.
Mission Impossible being one of those series that completely divides me and Jim. Except for the Mission Impossible 1, which we both hate.
Hate is far too kind of a word.
Yes, but there are certain things that you can't say on recording because they can be used as evidence. But that being said, I know that I enjoyed Mission Impossible 2 and 3 more than you did. I actually found Mission Impossible 3 to be the one that held closest to the original television series. You can actually tell that J.J. Abrams had seen the show, or at least made an effort to put elements from the show into the movie.
I will agree that Mission Impossible 3 was the least offensive of the trilogy. But as we've said before, you can polish a turd, but it's still a turd. It was a nice, round, spherical, highly polished turd, but it was still a turd.
Yeah, I agree with that in Mythbusters terms. However, I thought Mission Impossible 3 was a very passable movie, and I thought Mission Impossible 2 was a passable movie to a lesser extent. I thought it was a great action-adventure flick, just a terrible Mission Impossible interpretation.
See, as a John Woo fan, I really felt that Mission Impossible 2 did not live up to his potential as a director. John Woo is world-renowned for his action-adventure movies. The Mexican standoff appears in almost every one of his films, and even though you know it's coming, you sit there and go, okay, here it comes, yes! He's taken the action-adventure genre to a whole nother level. The fact that most of the work that he has done has been in Hong Kong means that about 90% of the people in the United States don't have a clue as to who he is. And I have a very distinct feeling that Mission Impossible 2 was what happens when John Woo meets an American production company. And in my opinion, that was a detriment to his work.
I agree with that completely. When you look at somebody like Jackie Chan's first entry into American filmmaking, you end up with Cannonball Run. And all kidding aside, that was a crappy role for him. Luckily, he was willing to come back to America and give us another chance. Really, John Woo's American movies are pretty crappy. Stuff like Face Off.
See, I actually thought Face Off was better than Mission Impossible 2. But then again, we go back to that whole polished turd thing.
It was definitely a polished turd. I like John Travolta, I like Nick Cage, but that movie was barely watchable.
It was even a great concept. It just ended up being poorly executed because, again, I think it's a case of the industry got in the way of a great director doing his job.
But we digress away from J.J. Abrams. Maybe John Woo could be our next triple threat.
I think that we haven't detoured that far off the mark because of the fact that J.J. Abrams has shown himself to be able to take a franchise and do something great with it. I just think that walking into the third installment of that franchise, he had a lot of limitations put on him. He had to adhere to certain things that had come before it, and those are actually the things that I didn't like. You know, things like it had to star Tom Cruise.
Hard to argue with you on that point.
That does bring me to another point on the Mission Impossible movies. It's not that I hate Tom Cruise. In reality, I like about 50% of his movies. I like Ving Rhames, who also plays a very significant part in the franchise. I liked John Woo as a director. I have an appreciation for the work of J.J. Abrams. But you take all of those good things and you roll them together and it doesn't guarantee that you're going to get a good movie.
That's true with any movie. I certainly think J.J. Abrams was much more successful in reinvigorating a franchise with Star Trek.
Oh, by and large. In spite of all the reboot haters, I'm sorry to say this, as big of a Star Trek fan as I am, but Star Trek was in its death throes. each movie was getting worse and worse. The ratings were going further and further down. Fans were leaving by the boatful, and they needed to do something to put people back in the seats again. And no matter what anybody says about the new Star Trek film, Abrams has succeeded in doing that. He has gotten people to go, "Ooh, Star Trek! I can't wait to see the next installment." And we're not talking about the 2 million or so Star Trek fans that were already out there. We're talking
my mother
and my niece. You're bringing in three different generations all into the same movie and going, "Hey, I really liked that. It needed it."
Rick Berman is just a piece of shit. I mean, he really incredibly drove this franchise into the ground. And every time he grind his fist and push it a little bit deeper into the ground, he'd go, "It's been 40 years. It's the end of the run. The fans just don't care about it anymore." And what he didn't understand is it was him. He was the one that was pushing the people away. He just did not get Star Trek. And what I really like about what J.J. Abrams did is he rebooted this in a way that makes it appeal to that wide audience, the three generations of people, without giving up on those things that the original Star Trek fans enjoyed.
It's got the excitement. It's got the adventure. I really hope that the next film is able to tap a little bit more into the exploration aspect of things. If there was one thing that I felt was missing from the new movie, it was that feeling of exploration. The boldly going where no one has gone before.
Just kind of expound upon what you're saying. I think what they did very well was the wagon train to the stars. They had the six shooters, they had the Romulans were the Indians, and the Federation were the cowboys. I mean, they did that really well. What they missed was that cerebral nature that Gene Roddenberry and Gene Coon really brought to this. And it was something that in the first pilot for Star Trek, they're like, "Wow, this is really good, but it's all about thought. You've got to put some more action adventure into it." So what he did really well is encourage the action and adventure while playing down, for the most part, the thought and the cerebralness that Star Trek had. I don't mean that as a slam against J.J. Abrams. I'm not saying it was a stupid movie. I just mean that was not the important part of this particular story.
And Abrams has shown that he can do the thought-provoking storylines. You look at shows like Lost and realize that he has taken his time to build up both the science fiction and the science aspects of the world around him. His newest project is really good at that precise thing. So I know he can do it. It's just a matter of finding a way to do it without alienating the morons.
That's tough, considering how large a percentage of the population the morons represent. I mean, really? We could probably spend another hour here continuing to discuss Star Trek.
At least.
I would love to go into everything about this movie that I think he did right. But Abrams has other stuff out there. Now, as a producer, he has probably one of my favorite movies of 2008. Not a movie for everybody. I will really preface that. It's certainly a niche audience movie, but Cloverfield.
Based on your recommendation, and you know my tastes fairly well, I did not see Cloverfield. You said that it was going to give me motion sickness, and I definitely took your word on that.
You know, it's one of the movies that, for me, the camera jerking and the fast movement and stuff, it's very hard for me. So to sit and recommend this to people that I know it's even harder for, it's tough. Well, first of all, it's like Blair Witch on steroids.
A horrible movie in and of itself.
Yes, it was. Cloverfield was as if you took Blair Witch and Godzilla and you mixed them together and put the monster in New York. It was meant to be the American giant monster movie. If you compare it to the Matthew Broderick Godzilla movie, it's a 4-star Oscar fest. And not to downplay anybody, I thought they were all spectacular actors and actresses in this movie. But because of how they filmed it and kept it low budget, you can't take young people to see it. It's too violent. You can't take old people to it. It's got too much motion sickness. And then you get a very narrow group in the middle who like monster movies. If you fall into that middle category, I recommend it. 2 thumbs up, 4 stars, 5 pens in the pocket protector. I can't say enough good things about this movie. But I need to warn you that you have to fit into that middle section.
But apparently that is a very large niche, because it made a buco load of buckos.
Well, considering how they really did this movie on the cheap, it didn't take a lot of people to see it to make a lot of money.
I mean, it didn't make Star Trek money or anything, but it made its money back and then some.
Obviously, I'm awaiting the sequel to Star Trek and Cloverfield. Oh, yeah, it's the Enterprise versus the Cloverfield monster. But I think that brings us to his most recent project.
Even more recent than Star Trek, because it did get renewed for a second season, and that's Fringe.
Earlier, when you were describing this project as really hitting the nail on the head when he's talking about science and the cerebral things, that's what he did best with this.
Also, when we talk about him doing the Strange shows, this is the pinnacle of Strange shows for him.
Episode 1, he took off the gloves and said, no kid punches.
Yeah, within the first 5 minutes, you're going, okay, this is weird.
It's the only television show I've ever seen where somebody's jaw falls off in the opening sequence.
And gets past the ratings board. Now, theoretically, Fringe stars Anna Torv as Special Agent Olivia Dunham. She works for the FBI and is assigned to these weird cases. I say theoretically because, in spite of the fact that it's quite clear that she's intended to be the lead character, she is far overshadowed, both by Joshua Jackson as Peter Bishop and John Noble as Dr. Walter Bishop, two people who help her in her investigations.
On our last episode of TorpCast, I complimented Brian Austin Green from 90210 for his performance in the Sarah Connor Chronicles. I can't believe that I'm actually quoting that again. But I have to give him his due if I'm going to say that Joshua Jackson from Dawson's Creek was spectacular in this show. It's proof that just because you're on one of these teeny bopper shows doesn't mean you're a bad actor. In other words, there's hope for Miley Cyrus.
But likewise, there's no hope for Shannen Doherty.
Who?
When this show was introduced to me, I thought, okay, J.J. Abrams, I've had warm and cold feelings about his work, so I'll give it a try. When I learned that it starred Joshua Jackson, I went, oh god, okay, I'll give it a try, but I'm not going to like this. I could not have been more wrong. As Peter Bishop, the put-upon son of an evil genius, and that really is what Walter is. He is an evil genius who doesn't quite realize that he's evil.
He would classify himself, I believe, as amoral.
And Peter is his son who is brought into this situation because Walter needs a caregiver. He has been institutionalized for the last 17 years or so, and in order for the FBI to make use of his talents, he needs to have a family member who's willing to become his guardian. And that person happens to be his son, which in and of itself is just an interesting character interaction, because Peter the son is more times than not the father figure of the duo. He's the one who makes sure that Walter gets dressed in the morning. He's the one who makes sure that Walter doesn't blow up the lab. He's the one who makes sure that when Walter is talking about how cool it is to disembody somebody, he's the one who sits there and says, "You're scaring the straights, Ray."
But for as good of a job as he does with this role, and he does take this father figure from the son role very seriously, the person who steals every scene he's in is John Noble. He is such an upstager, and I don't think he does this intentionally. It's just the way the show is written and how fantastic an actor he is.
Walter Bishop can be standing in the back of the scene, playing with his cow, and yes, he has a cow in his lab, while Olivia and Peter are talking in the foreground. And that is the scene that you're supposed to be concentrating on. That's the one that's going to give you all the information that you need. But you're going to miss half of it because of what he's doing in the background.
It's true. He gets all the good lines and all the good scenes. I mean, you could be in a scene where somebody's brain has literally melted and dripped out their nose. He's like, you know what that reminds me of? No, what, Walter? What does that remind you of? I'd like to get some soup.
Some strawberry ice cream would be wonderful right about now. Would you go and find me some strawberry ice cream?
And okay, the food thing is a running gag in the show, but John Noble is just so good. And he can do these lines with a straight face. I can't imagine what rehearsal would be like.
So between John and Joshua, this is a fantastic show. And whether it's the humorous stuff that you almost feel bad about laughing at, or if it's the scientific explanation as to how a beam of light could travel across three cities to melt that person's brain, you can believe what they're saying in either case, no matter how unbelievable the circumstances are.
Maybe that's part of the key, is the fact that they're telling you these awesome, fantastic scientific things that are quite obviously impossible. And then you get all of a sudden that wham humor hits you, and you forget that you're thinking about something impossible, and you're just thinking about, oh, gross, the brains look like soup.
And have made him hungry.
One of my favorite lines that Joshua has portrayed with Peter Bishop is, and yet another food I can never eat again.
As long as we're talking about comedic timing and people working well together, a shout also has to go out to Jessica Nicole. And if I butchered her name, it's my deepest apologies. But she plays Astrid Farnsworth, another FBI agent who has been assigned to be Walter's lab assistant. And the suffering this poor woman goes through on a weekly basis is both heart-wrenching and hilarious at the same time.
I understand from the rumor mill, anyways, that she's actually going to get an expanded part next season. She has just been the lab assistant this season, who Walter cannot remember her name for the life of him.
Of course, Walter's doing good to remember his own name most days.
But the actress is just so good. If the rumor is true that she's going to get into more of the story, that would be a marvelous thing.
Needless to say, we were very happy that Fringe got picked up for a second season. By episode 5, I really thought it was a goner. Fox, in its infinite wisdom, seemed to be doing everything within its power to kill the show, and it was only because of its strong storytelling and great performances that kept people coming back after excruciatingly long hiatuses to pick up the show yet again. There were numerous times where the show went off the air for a good month for yet another special episode of American Idol or some other absolute monumental waste of time. That I sat there and went, you know, I don't know if I really care enough about this show at this point to continue watching it. After all, it's just going to get canceled. It had it written all over it. And then I would catch the new episode and go, oh yeah, that's why I love it. That's why I keep coming back. It's hilarious. It's great. It's great science fiction. It's wonderful. And I'd watch the next two or three episodes, and then they'd have another special episode of American Puke.
And if I could tie this back into the Star Trek reference, Leonard Nimoy came in for the final episode of this season as the big mystery character, William Bell.
Which brings us full circle to another one of J.J. Abrams' traits. He has a tendency of making friends with people that he works with, and then turning around and trying to get them involved in as many of his projects as he can. He loves working with his friends, and who can blame him?
I think that the most obvious example is Greg Grudenberg, who has been in almost everything that J.J. Abrams has ever done. He hasn't been in Fringe, but there's still next season.
That and he has a regular gig on Heroes.
Doesn't mean he can't do a guest appearance, but thankfully J.J. Abrams let him out of Gone Fishing. So, you know, he has some mercy for his friends.
And hey, if you can make friends with Leonard Nimoy, more power to ya.
Did I tell you, Jim, that I met Leonard Nimoy October 23rd, 1995?
Yeah, and how often do you talk to him? What number is he on your speed dial?
He's number one on my speed dial. Never answers, but he's number one on my speed dial.
And you got the most recent phone number change, right? Is that 500-yard restraining order still in effect?
Oh, no, that's been out of effect for a long time. It's 1,000 yards now.
But yeah, he goes out of his way to make sure that his friends at least make a guest appearance, if not have starring roles. Like Doug said, Greg is the most active one, and in case you missed his guest appearance in Star Trek, he was Jim Kirk's stepdad who owned the car and was screaming at him over the phone. That was Greg. He first worked with Carrie Russell in Felicity, but then brought her back when he was doing Mission Impossible 3 to play a fellow spy and former lover of Ethan Hawke's.
Jennifer Gardner, of Alias fame, started on Felicity. Terry O'Quinn, Ian Gomez, John Cho. He sees them, he sees their talent, and he reuses them.
And there's a pretty good chance that their phones are going to be ringing again. J.J. Abrams, especially after the huge success of Star Trek, is one of the hot commodities in Hollywood right now. Everybody wants a piece of him.
Which piece? We are not saying.
Currently for sure on his docket is the second season of Fringe, along with a film that's due out in 2010 called Morning Glory.
But the rumor mill is afloat. You've got rumors of a second Cloverfield movie, a Star Trek sequel, Mission Impossible 4, and if rumors hold true, he's going to add another franchise to his belt, Stephen King's Dark Tower.
His name has even been attached to a film based on the life of Hunter Scott, who is a researcher into historical oceanic military battles and apparently is some sort of prodigy. At the age of 20, he was considered to be the foremost authority on the USS Indianapolis. How exactly you're going to make a movie based on the very young life of a researcher, I'm not sure, but if anybody can do it, I guess J.J. Abrams can probably find a way.
I have three suggestions. Car chases, explosions, and gunfights.
Right. I don't think you're going to find any of those three, though, in his next work for television, which is going to be an HBO series called Anatomy of Hope. You will probably get your fourth favorite subject in there.
TNA?
Exactly. It's HBO. That's due out sometime in 2011.
What can I say? I like Anatomy. Well, I think that you can tell here that we've got a couple of admirers who have really enjoyed the work of J.J. Abrams.
I haven't always enjoyed every single thing that he's produced, but I do admire the fact that he has done so much in such a short period of time and has established himself in an industry that oftentimes looks down their nose at his type of storytelling.
And really, he's done the good, the bad, and the ugly. I mean, they're all there. But the overall body of work is an enormous success.
He is a director of today and the future.
We'd like to thank you for listening to Abrams Cast and keeping us on the net for our third year now.
Please continue to join us as we go into that third year.
As always, we encourage your feedback. Please write jim@tworponline.net. We can also be found on Facebook, MySpace, and Zanga.
TworpCast is a production of Timewell Electronic Recording Productions. Copyright 2009.